Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Thursday, August 20th. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News, and I'm joined, as always, in the studio by Christopher Wynn.
Christopher.
Hello, C. Wagner.
Hello. How are you?
Christopher.
Christopher. I'm sorry. Say it. Who was that again?
Christopher.
Yes.
That is not what I thought you were.
That's Adriana Lacerda from The Sopranos greeting you.
Christopher. Christopher.
One more time.
Christopher.
That's Christopher. We also have the great Lauren Smart in the studio, as always. She is the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, do I get it? Do I get a greeting?
We need to come up with a funny drop for you.
I feel so left out.
You need a drop, yeah.
I'll work on it. I'll comb the Sopranos archives a little bit more. On today's show, Dallas-born movie star Owen Wilson is taking his career down a new path in No Escape, a movie that Wilson says being a father helped define. We'll talk about it all with writer Michael Granberry, who profiles the actor in this Sunday's Dallas Morning News on page 1A, I might say.
Oh.
Yeah, he's big time. Next up, punk and metal documentaries. The trilogy The Decline of the Western Civilization screens this weekend at the Texas Theater with director Penelope Spheris in attendance. We'll discuss the impact of these films shot between 1979 and 1998 with FD Magazine digital editor Christopher Mosley, who credits them with inspiring his early freelance work in music journalism. And finally, last and perhaps least, fans of the 2001 cult classic film Wet Hot American Summer finally got their long-awaited follow-up when Netflix released the TV series prequel recently, Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp. Was it worth reviving? GuideLive.com editor Amanda Wilkins joins us to talk about that. We'll also consider other summer camp films and share our own memories of attending or perhaps avoiding camp. But first, Christopher Wynn's feeling very strange about taping in the morning.
Yeah, so we're recording in the morning for the first time because of some weird scheduling, and it's messing up my world. My day started with a malfunctioning Keurig coffee maker.
How does that happen exactly? Yeah. I mean, isn't a Keurig like malfunction proof?
It made some weird noises. I heard gurgling, and I came back around the corner. I had a half a cup of sludge.
Awesome.
And I knew then. It was sort of a metaphor for how the day was going to go.
Maybe it was just really strong.
I drank it.
Yeah, did you drink it?
I was desperate. I did. I was desperate.
That's disgusting.
So that happened. Then I got to the office and our elevator is out. I'm surprised we're all here today. I actually got trapped in the elevator temporarily.
I take the stairs, personally.
You should.
So there you go.
Well, luckily the elevator repair guy actually got in with me on the second round. He said, oh, we're getting a new, motherboard.
So he was just there in the elevator with you? He happened to be there?
The doors wouldn't open, and when they finally opened on the wrong floor, he stepped in. And
awesome.
It was like God stepped into the elevator to save me.
Hey, the elevator's broken, and oh, there's the elevator repair guy. That's
happy
amazing.
To see him.
But enough of that. Let's get started. Say something good looker. Dallas's own Owen Wilson, excuse me, Mr. Wilson, for stumbling over your first name, has a new movie out. It's an action adventure. It's a slightly different approach for Dallas's own Owen Wilson. With us to talk about it all is our staff Wilson chronicler, Michael Granberry. How are you, Michael?
Good morning, Chris.
So first of all, I want to know if the movie's any good. We got to start there.
Well, it's totally different from any Owen Wilson movie you've seen before because it's very high-octane action suspense. It's not comedy at all. And, I brought up to him the fact that it's interesting to me that you are doing this movie at the same time that your old buddy Vince Vaughn from Wedding Crashers did a dramatic role in True Detective. And he said that was purely coincidental. It wasn't really a career shift for him or for Vince, but it is a very different movie. I'm curious to see how people are going to react to it.
And I ask you again, is the movie any good?
Well, it's definitely an edge of your seat type thriller. I mean, it does literally keep you on the edge of your seat. I think it's a good movie, but I think there are some problems with the movie. I think the performances are quite good. Owen and Lake Bell and the two kids are amazing.
Is Owen Wilson believable as an action star?
He is. He is. And he actually doesn't really see any difference between the comedic Owen Wilson and this one. But I don't think it you know, represents any kind of big career shift for him. I mean, as he pointed out, he just finished Zoolander 2 or something. So, you know, he hasn't exactly given up comedy.
So the story that you wrote for Sunday is really as much about the Wilson family as it is about Owen and his film career, particularly his father, Bob. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with the patriarch Wilson and how that part of their conversation went with Owen?
Well, one thing we laughed about is I first met Owen in 1999. This is back when we had the high profile section. I did a high profile on Owen and Andrew and Luke. And this is when they were really just beginning in Hollywood. I mean, they had Bottle Rocket had come out, the long version of Bottle Rocket in 96. And they had a movie coming out called Rushmore, which Owen had co-written with his college roommate, Wes Anderson.
Some guy named Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
Some guy named Wes Anderson. And this was a very fun story to do. That, you know, they sent me out to L.A. And I remember interviewing Luke and Wes in the house that Wes and Luke and Owen had, this house in Hancock Park, which is kind of a funky part of Los Angeles. And the thing that I always remember about the house is they had this gigantic mural of Dwight Eisenhower in the living room. And I've never gotten an answer as to why that was there, you know. Every time I ask, they change the subject. But then in connection with doing that profile, I got to meet the parents, Bob and Laura. And I joked to Owen because after that, I profiled Bob and I profiled Laura, and he now refers to me as the family's Boswell. I'm the unofficial family biographer. But one of the things that comes out in the story is that, and people who know the family well have known this for a while, Bob is suffering from Alzheimer's disease. He is being cared for in the family home. He has 24/7 care. But as you might imagine, it's taken a toll on the family because the boys were quite close to their dad, who was an extraordinary man and really a kind of pivotal figure in Dallas history. He was running Channel 13, KERA, started doing that in 1967. And this was at a time when the Dallas newspapers were really not that good. You know, the morning news really didn't begin to change until about 1980. The Times Herald was nothing special, I would say. And he hired Jim Lehrer from the Dallas Times Herald and launched a program called Newsroom, which was 1970, the year that I entered college. As a journalism major, this one was an incredible program. I mean, these were great journalists. Lee Cullum was one of the people.
Love Lee Cullum.
Yeah, one of the people on Newsroom. This guy, Mike Ritchie, who was extraordinary. I mean, really well-written.
Wasn't he also instrumental in bringing Monty Python?
Absolutely.
To the American airwaves?
He did do that. And so he had this incredible career, and then he ended up becoming an author. And I used to go to lunch with Bob, and I always treasured those times because he was an extraordinary conversationalist. And Owen was telling me, you know, that's one of the tough things, because they just loved talking to their dad. He was also a very devoted dad. There's a quote in my story from Andrew, the oldest son, who turns 51 on Saturday.
Wow.
Who remembers, he ended up at Deerfield Academy in the Northeast. And he said, you know, one day they're playing a football game or something, and it's cold. It's very cold. And the game is in Vermont. It's a road game. And he looks up, and there's his dad standing on the sideline. And he said he didn't miss a game, even when they were, you know, when he was going to a school in New England. So there's a very strong bond there.
You know, to your point, also their mother, Laura Wilson, is an accomplished photographer.
Right.
She spent 6 years with Avedon, working with him, kind of mentored by him. She's an amazing woman, and I had a chance to collaborate on a story with her for FD one time, and she was so generous. And, you know, Christopher, what do you think? And what do you feel? You know, does this work for you? And I was just like, yes, Laura. Yes.
Whatever you say, Laura.
Yeah. She was so generous. And the family is very close. I mean, I remember she had a clipping of when the Wedding Crashers came out. She had ripped out an ad for it, and that was up on their refrigerator in the house. You know, pictures of the boys everywhere. It's a very close-knit family.
Yeah, one of the things that I admire them is about them greatly is they're very, you know, they have, I guess many people would say they have an unconventional family. None of the boys graduated from college, and yet they're very successful. And one of the things the parents did when the boys were quite young is, rather than exclude them from these gatherings they would have in the home with these extraordinary people, they made a point of including them every time. So the boys got to know people like Richard Avedon and Tom Wolfe and Jim Lehrer, and they were always a part of that group. And Laura is amazing. She's an incredible photographer. A lot of her work has appeared in Vanity Fair and Texas Monthly, and I should note she has a major exhibition of her work, which opens September 5th at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art in Fort Worth. I mean, she's, you know, as one of the people quoted in the story said, I mean, she is a great mom, but she's also this extraordinary photographer.
When I think to the point of the success of the children, I am curious, maybe just in this room right now, why is it, do we think, that Owen has sort of become such a prominent figure in American Hollywood?
The butterscotch stallion?
As compared to, I mean, Luke is a very handsome man, very talented, but yet Owen is the one that you see, he's in everything, it seems like. I don't know if there's any...
It's the nose, it's the blonde hair.
The nose, he's got that kind of, he almost reminds me of a California Texan. He's got the blonde
right.
hair,
yeah.
surfer dude thing going, but at the same time, he is very much of Dallas and of Texas. And I think in a way, that's an almost exotic mix for Hollywood.
Yeah, one of the, you know, Lauren, that's a good question. One of the things I'll go back to is the profile that I did. And he said the most interesting thing. I mean, this is all the way back in 99, but I think it kind of answers your question. He was actually kicked out of St. Mark's School of Texas. And it was because he had managed to get a copy of the teacher's edition of a textbook. So he had the answers in advance.
Does not surprise me.
And I guess it speaks well of St. Mark's in the sense that his father was on the board. His father was a prominent person, but they would not tolerate that. So he was kicked out totally on his own. His parents had nothing to do with this. He enrolls himself in the New Mexico Military Academy. I don't remember the exact title, but it's this—you know—it's this military school in New Mexico.
So, sounding very bottle rocket. All
yeah,
of a sudden.
and he said that was extraordinarily helpful to him. It was like being in Marine boot camp for the remainder of high school. That's where his high school diploma is from. Is from this New Mexico Military Institute, and he said they fostered a sense of discipline that has never left him, that it turned his whole life around. And he said it has helped him greatly in Hollywood. And even Luke said that Owen has been a real example, because when they were first out there together, they would just pound the pavement. I mean, they would never, you know, they were rejected, but they never would accept rejection. They just kept going and going and going and going. And I think Owen is very driven. And that's one of the reasons. He benefited greatly from that.
Bob Wilson has described the family as 3 boys, 7 high schools, 9 colleges, no degrees.
Yeah, that was that was Owen's description. He was on the David Letterman show once, and Letterman said, 3 boys, that must have been tough on your parents. And and that was Owen's quote then.
So that was Owen who said
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Owen said that to David okay. Letterman, right, in describing the whole situation.
So we have to ask you, did you approach the subject of Owen's alleged suicide
no.
attempt in this interview?
No, we didn't bring it up.
Did you consider approaching
I mean, you know, he's, you know, moved well beyond that, and I don't know that he's ever really publicly talked about that.
I don't think he has.
Yeah. No.
He's had a lot of up and downs, and even it's interesting with his children. He has a 2-year-old son by his former girlfriend, his other child born about a year and a half ago with a Swedish-born personal trainer.
They're actually 4.5 and 1.5.
4.5 and 1.5. I thought it was interesting. They're not together, I guess, is my understanding. She had told a Swedish newspaper at the time, and I pulled it here because I thought it was interesting. Owen and I have decided to have a child together even though we're not in a relationship. And we're not planning on starting a relationship either. Owen and I are 2 close friends having a baby together.
Right.
Something,
right.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very attached to the kids, and which is not surprising because he grew up in a very close family. You know, the parents were very attached to them, and I think he would be a good dad. I think his own dad was a terrific dad, so you know, I think he would be as well. And his older brother Andrew has three kids.
I think it's interesting too that Owen has kind of become the Dallas go-to celebrity. I mean, he was the chair of the events at when Clyde Warren Park opened. His voice is in the Perot Museum, I love that he's sort of this, like, I like that idea of a California Texan, and his voice is sort of becoming the Dallas Hollywood voice, you know, the connection. I think it's really interesting.
You know, it was always fun to talk to Bob about being the dad of these boys, and I said, you know, what, anything hard to get used to? And he said, well, there was a period when young women would throw their panties on the lawn with notes in them. And he said that was a little weird.
And then
he said it would also be weird in the middle of the night. You'd hear someone in the kitchen and you would go in there and Gwyneth Paltrow would be there having a glass of milk or something. You know, it was not the ordinary experience, you know, that parents have. So, I mean, there was a whole parade of famous women that these boys went out with. I mean, Drew Barrymore, Gwyneth Paltrow, Sheryl Crow. It was really interesting because one of the things Bob and I used to talk about was the experience of being a father and when your boys are old enough to bring young women home. And you would find yourself kind of getting attached to the ones they would bring home, and then it would be very sad for you when they would break up with them. It would almost be like you were kind of breaking up as well, right, as parents. And he especially felt that way about Sheryl Crow. You know, he got very close to her and her parents, and so I've been through that myself, you know, where why did you break up with her?
No Escape opens next Wednesday, August 26th, and you can read Michael Granberry's piece on Owen Wilson and the rest of the Wilson family in this Sunday's Dallas Morning News on the front page, I should say.
Woo-hoo.
On the front page. Thank you, Michael, for joining us.
Thank you.
In 65, tension was running high at my school.
It's a black flag.
This Friday through Sunday, the Texas Theater will show the epic heavy metal and punk rock trilogy, The Decline of Western Civilization. Penelope Spheris, the filmmaker, will be in attendance both Friday and Saturday. Part one is about the early hardcore scene. That's Black Flag you're listening to right there. The Los Angeles punk scene of the late 70s and early 80s. Part two gets into the hair metal world of LA in the late 80s. And then part three is about the gutter punks of Los Angeles in the late 90s. Worth watching as a whole. Part two is worth watching as one of the funniest movies you'll ever see. Joining us to talk about the decline of Western civilization is the great Christopher Mosley. Hello, Christopher.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Good. So how did this help inspire you to become a music journalist? What was it about part one of Decline of Western Civilization?
The record was originally the first exposure I had to the documentary. There was just the soundtrack, and the soundtrack had interviews mixed in between songs, and Penelope Spheris, her sort of unflinching, you know, look at the actual humanity behind the music, I think really is what influenced me a lot. She kind of treated it with respect, even though these were kids being kind of silly and even violent sometimes, but you know, you never felt like she was being condescending to them.
I was struck by how she almost treated them as peers.
Right.
I mean, she's a fan and she doesn't come across as a fangirl, but you're right, she treats them, you know, eye to eye with respect, not with a smirk, even in part two, which really is very,
very smirkable,
which is very funny in its own way.
Yeah, sometimes you find it hard to believe that she could keep her composure through some of those interviews. I mean, these guys are kind of making fools of themselves sometimes. But she, you know, when you see behind the scenes stuff with her, she does seem slightly agenda driven a little bit. Like she says, she wants to bury the 70s, and that's not, you know, unbiased journalism. But it was well received at the time. Actually, I was going through booklet that comes with the box set, and there's a lot of quotes in there from the Dallas Morning News, actually, which I was surprised by as being one of the media outlets that, you know, actually said it was a great film. So
that is surprising for that era. Actually.
Right, yeah.
Well, I'm curious, like, what, if you can pinpoint, because you would know better than I would, if you could pinpoint what it was about that music or that era that she was so drawn to that she wanted to make, why she wanted to make that movie in the first place. What was so different?
Well, there's a lot of talk in there about how, you know, the Doobie Brothers and things like that had made this kind of calm, cool, collected sort of pop culture. And, you know, the punk movement was against all that. And it was reacting to a lot of, I mean, originally in Britain, obviously, it was reacting to how bad things were economically in London. And that's why LA is really interesting, because it's like the opposite of London in so many ways. And so there's this sort of view on it, you know, why would all these affluent kids be so upset? But I mean, of course, all kids are upset. So I don't think it's specific to just being poor in England in the late 70s.
You know, upset and also very self-destructive. I was struck by that looking at, you know, when she focused on the germs from, you know, in part one, for example, and just how, you know, people cutting themselves with glass and the shows and the drugs and the drinking, which she didn't shy away from. And, you know, it's interesting how that became a thread that ran through all three films.
Well, Darby Crash of the Germs is no longer with us.
Who killed himself.
Yeah, yeah. Because of that self-destructive urge. And we see a lot of that in part three, mm-hmm. Which is easily the saddest of the three films. I like to say that part two is the comedy and part three is the tragedy. Very
Paul Stanley laying around the bed with a bunch of lingerie.
That's
collab models.
That's part two. That's part two. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you elaborate for us why you say it's the comedy?
Because these guys are kind of idiots, and they're treated with, as Christopher was saying, a lot of, you know, even-handed respect, and it's also deadpan, and they're just being themselves. I don't think she's trying to give them enough rope, as they say. But I think they're doing a pretty good job of supplying it themselves. They're kind of Neanderthals.
And the flip side of that is she interviews someone, I think it's in part two, she interviews someone about all the stuff they wear, all the collars and the wristband, you know, all the jewelry they're basically wearing. And this woman is like this very conservative person. And she's like, this is a collar. It could also be used as a weapon if they ended up in a chokehold. And she's just so very serious about things that now are kind of kitschy.
And she does, Penelope Spheeris does something really smart with that sequence. She intercuts the woman talking about the hazards of spikes and whatnot with the kids being just aggressively patted down by the police going into a punk show, just full on, you know, body search, butt squeezing, the whole nine yards. So she's really good at making visual matches like that through editing, especially. She's a damn good filmmaker.
Yeah, she was a behavioral psychologist as like her background, her first major, I guess. And you can really pick up on that, because when she gets a little thread of emotion, she just starts hammering with one question after another about, you know, a person's background or abuse, et cetera. So she's just really good at picking up on cues, I think.
She also had that moment that I thought was very powerful when she was asking, I think it was in part two, you know, what will you do if you don't make it? And everybody, of course, was like, of course I'm going to make it.
Yeah, what are you talking about? What a stupid question.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to, you know, what will you be doing in 10 years if you
Odin.
Don't make it? Yeah.
Odin's going to make it, of course.
And, you know, and of course, from our perspective all these years later, we know we, you know, nothing
we happened. Know who's made it
yeah
or who
exactly
hasn't, right?
And it's very poignant and sad, and it makes you realize for every person who does make it, there's, you know, a sea of corpses behind them of people who don't.
Yeah, I thought it was more funny than sad, because we sort of know that these guys are not going to make it, and I don't know if they necessarily deserve to make it. I think part three is sad
they
because
had the teased hair and the makeup.
Yeah, they got the feathered hair and everything else. Part three is sad because these kids know, or at least think, that they're probably going to die soon. I mean, they're living on the streets. They're panhandling for beer money. They all come from just horrible homes that they describe, and a few of them are actually dead. So to me, that's the sad stuff. I think part two is the comic relief. And then if you really want to get sad, Christopher Wynn, then, then watch part three.
What's sad and funny is that famous pool interview with, is it Chris Holmes?
Chris Holmes of Wasp.
Of Wasp.
That is kind of sad and really funny.
I mean, Chris basically fully dressed, floating around in the swimming pool with multiple bottles of vodka while his sort of prim and proper mother is sitting with her arms folded in a lawn chair beside the pool.
Just staring darts just into staring. The camera.
You know, and Penelope's filming and asking questions, and he's talking about, yeah, you know, when I go to my hotel room, there's like, you know, four babes lined up, and if they won't drop their drawers, then I have security haul them out. And he's laughing, and she, Penelope, kind of looks at his mother like, well, what do you think of that? And she's like, oh, I try not to think about that.
Smart woman.
It's like, well, I don't know. It's funny, and then it's very sad. I mean, he clearly is drunk and has a problem. And
well, I'm curious, Mosley, do you know if the L.A. music scene, the way that these films follow one another, is it's chronological order?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it kind of like devolves into the gutter punk era, and like you said, Chris, in a very like tragic way. Is there any reason that you can kind of pinpoint from the movies or what else you would know about the scene that it culminated in that way?
I think the third film's interesting because she's sort of circling back to the beginning, and it's I actually didn't see it. The third one until last night because it was never released. It only played at film festivals in the 90s. And it's sort of a weird tribute to itself, which, you know, I think it has to end there because you start devolving into nostalgia. She interviews someone that was in the first film. And so, yeah, I think it's just a good snapshot of confused 90s culture, basically, that at that time things weren't really progressing. You were just retreading things that happened 20 years earlier. So it's sort of a snapshot of this kind of stunted culture. But overall, I mean, the films have done well as far as she ends up on like a LACMA panel with some of the failed people from the second film. I saw like a guy from London. Who was in the second film.
The band London, not the city London.
Right, the band London. And so she says now she's, the film's shown in like universities and museums all over the world. So I think it ended up okay for her.
What did she go on to do?
Penelope Spheeris is best known for directing the Wayne's World movie. She directed Black Sheep as well with Chris Farley. Those are probably her two biggest mainstream hits. But she considers this trilogy her biggest artistic achievement. She was offered the chance to direct This Is Spinal Tap, and she turned it down because she didn't want to make fun of heavy metal, which
in your mind is.
Which is, well, I mean, it's one of the reasons why part two is so funny is that she does not approach it as a comedy. She's not saying, look at these jerks. She's basically just interviewing them and letting them be themselves. And just as I said earlier, the deadpanness of it all is what makes it funny, is what brings the comedic element to that movie.
I thought it was interesting that you pointed out in your piece, though, Chris, that she didn't think it was funny at the time.
No, she didn't.
Her producers were laughing at the footage.
Her producers directed Little Miss Sunshine mm-hmm. a few years ago, a huge indie film hit. They're the ones that were watching the footage and saying, this is hilarious. They couldn't stop laughing. And Penelope Spheeris is like, this isn't funny. Why are you laughing at these guys? They're just being who they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that approach that she took is what makes it funny.
So, Chris, Chris Mosley, will you be attending this weekend or seeing all three on the big screen?
I think I'll see two of them. I think the third one is a tough watch because mm-hmm. of how tragic it is. But yeah, I'm looking forward to at least a couple of them.
And she'll be in attendance, correct?
She will be in attendance right. Friday and Saturday. She'll be doing a Q&A. Friday's Q&A will be with our own Robert Wolonski, the digital managing editor of the Dallas Morning News. But you should go anyway because it'll be really fun. Just kidding. Love you, Robert. Yeah, he's doing the Friday. And then I believe Jason Reimer, one of the Texas Theater mm-hmm. partners, will be doing the Q&A on Saturday. So, yeah, two nights with Penelope Spheeris. It's really cool. We should also give a shout-out to Shout Factory. They're the company that did the re-release box set and that's helping organize this tour that she's doing. And her daughter, Anna Fox, Penelope Spheeris' daughter, also was kind of a driving force behind getting these back out and saying, Mom, people really care about these movies, and they want to see the decline of Western
Black Flag
again. So that was Black Flag. Decline of Western Civilization shows at 8:30 p.m. Friday at the Texas Theater. Part 2, The Metal Years, shows at 9 p.m. Saturday. Part 3, The Gutter Punk Years, shows at 7:15 p.m. Sunday, 231 West Jefferson Boulevard in Dallas. As I said, Friday Q&A with the great Robert Wolanski. We'll be right back. The comedy Wet Hot American Summer came out in 2001. It has since become a cult comedy classic, helped get the careers going of people like Paul Rudd, Janine Garofalo, Bradley Cooper, Amy Poehler, and now it is back as a Netflix series, Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp, by popular demand. Joining us for the Wet Hot American segment of our show is GuideLive managing editor Amanda Wilkins.
Hello, hello, Amanda. Hello, thank you for having me.
How are you?
Great. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for joining the mixed media team.
Absolutely. I'm off today, so y'all really
are you really?
It. Yeah.
Oh, so wow. You came in on your day
special.
Off to do this?
Dedicated.
Wow.
On the wet, cold.
That's right. A cold
Thursday.
It's
cold,
not cold. It's like 75 degrees.
It's Texas cold.
We have to take it. Chris Mosley is wearing a sweater today. That's how cool it is.
That is kind of amazing, actually. All right, so let's. Why are you here to discuss this with us?
I think we have to first start with what was your original experience with Wet Hot when it came out in 2001? Did you see it? Were you among the 200,000 people that saw it?
So I was not among the people the very few people that saw it in the theater, apparently, because it flopped spectacularly. But I did see it at some point not too long after that on DVD, and I don't even know why or how, but. How it came across my scope, just because I was a fan of The State, mm-hmm. you know, and the guys from The State created the
MTV
movie.
Comedy
yeah, the MTV yeah. comedy series from the mid-90s. I was in college, you know, it was right in my weird comedy wheelhouse at the time. So probably I picked it up because of that. And
is that David Wayne?
David Wayne and Michael Showalter, who's the lead in Wet Hot, and
like Michael Ian Black.
Michael Ian Black, Joe Lotrulio. There's a bunch of people.
All funny guys.
Yes, very, very funny guys. I liked The State a lot. But when I first saw it, I have to say I didn't really connect with it that much. I thought, you know, this was funny or whatever, but it didn't really stick with me. But I've rewatched it since, and I understand why people are crazy about it. I think it's kind of a comedy nerds movie. I think it's one of those things where, you know, I've read a lot from Michael Showalter and David Wayne that where they say, you know, people will tell me that, you know, I use your movie as a litmus test. Like, do you like Wet Hot? Nope. Okay, we're probably not going to be friends. You know,
swipe to the left.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Whereas I would go the other way. I would say, do you like Wet Hot? Yes. Up. See ya.
That tells me everything I need to know about you. So, I think it's one of the most absurd films.
Absurd is the perfect word for it.
It's so ridiculous, and I think a lot of people really connect with that kind of humor where it's the narrative thread is, you know, just completely frayed, and it's a little bit of comic chaos, and I think, you know, that really is what a lot of people respond to.
I think I'd call it more broad than absurd. I mean, it has some absurdity, but it's also just incredibly broad. And I guess I felt like if the sight of grown-ups running around dressing like they're 15 or 16, if that's funny to you, then have at it, man. I watched the first episode, and I think at the time I tweeted that I went in operating the assumption that it was supposed to be funny, and I guess it was my mistake.
Not so much for you.
I think one of us should set up what exactly it even is.
Yes. Oh,
but there's a lot of people that won't know. That's
so overrated. So
if you haven't seen it, as clearly it's shaping up that I'm the only fan, the only true fan.
No, Amanda's a fan.
I will call myself a medium fan.
That's why she's coming around.
I'm not like a huge fan. I'm not one of the group.
It's basically, it's camp counselors, it's the last day of camp, and it's, you know, 30-year-olds playing, you know, teeny bopper 20-something camp counselors.
You can stop there.
In essence, it's sort of it's a series of sketch comedy routines strung together. But, I mean, you have great moments like Molly Shannon as an arts and craft teacher who's going through a bitter divorce, and the children are now giving her relationship advice.
That kid that gives her relationship advice is fantastic.
We need to let him go.
Are we talking about the movie or the TV series?
I'm talking about the original movie.
The original or in the movie.
Yeah. You know, there's a moment when all the counselors, you know, hey, we're going to town. Cool. And they load up in a pickup truck and go into town. And then they buy chips, and then somebody buys beer, and then suddenly they're smoking weed, and then there's this montage where they like rob an old lady to steal her handbag to go buy heroin. And
it's a full-on heroin bender, and it's amazing.
That's
hilarious. I think that might be my favorite scene.
They end
movie.
Up as crackheads in some smoked-out apartment, and then 20 seconds later they pull back up in camp, and they're like, "Hey, man, it's fun to go in town, even if it's just for an hour." I mean, you know, Skylab falls in the camp. I mean, it's just, it's absurd, over the top. And
yes.
It's so funny. And I think the reason it's maybe not working for you, Chris, and I know somewhat not so much for you either, Lauren, because we talked a little bit earlier, is because you're looking at it with 2015 eyes. I think when this came out, it was so fresh and original, and just how irreverent and just wheels off the entire thing was.
Great, so let's go back to 2001 and release the TV series instead of getting it on Netflix in 2015.
I think to Wagner's point, we're looking at it from 2015 eyes because
it's 2015!
and they decided they needed to come back, and Netflix gave them 8 episodes to go, I mean, to make a to reboot it
so
and do
Netflix
a series.
Has rebooted it. Now it's the first day of camp, so it's allegedly
it's a prequel.
It's X number of weeks before camp.
Yeah.
The joke is that everybody is quite a bit heavier and even older than they were before, but they're playing themselves even younger than in the movie.
That's
hilarious. Does show Chris hates.
Damn you, Wagner.
Do you know, does Showalter have an actual like? I swear he's wearing a fat, like a fake belly at one point.
It looks like it.
In the show.
Oh, that may be.
I mean, like they're just going so hard for this guy is so far from 18, it's ridiculous. And I don't know honestly whether that works or not, but it did amuse me, I have to say.
And then Paul Rudd has barely changed at all.
Oh, yeah. Paul Rudd looks exactly the same. It's not fair.
So who all went to camp?
Like as children?
Yeah, because I'm also thinking that maybe I don't get it necessarily because I never got anywhere. I never went anywhere when I was a kid. It was a very tragic childhood, I must say, and perhaps this explains why I have no sense of humor. No, I actually do. I just don't like this show. But who went to camp? Who has camp stories?
I went to church camp a lot.
Yeah.
But only church camp. I never went to one of these camps that you see in movies where they're there for 2 months and there's no Bible study at all. Like that was not
and no adults really. No,
yeah, which, I mean the counselors being 15.
Yeah, the adults being teenagers.
Yeah, I mean every camp I went to, there were moms everywhere, and like
my mom went with.
Oh yeah,
me.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
numerous times.
Yeah. What do you do at church camp?
You would be surprised. There's a lot more sports than you would think.
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, they're basically it's
sports,
like
sports, crass, and the Lord.
Yes, yes, and Bible trivia, very very competitive Bible trivia.
I'm so in.
Was your camp, Lauren, also a church camp?
Yeah, it was a church camp, and it was like horseback riding, archery.
Oh, we didn't have that. No,
but it wasn't like an inpatient kind of thing. You didn't stay there for weeks on end.
I think
end.
It was like 2 weeks, maybe.
The most I ever went was probably for a week or 10 days, something like that. So I actually really wanted that camp experience that you see like in Meatballs or whatever.
Little Darlings.
Yeah, Little Darlings, which I could talk about that for a real long time.
We should do a segment on that.
We can stop Wet Hot right now and talk about Little Darlings
Christy McNichol.
Well, I mean, you know, for me, that movie is not called Little Darlings. It's called Christy McNichol Wears Tank Tops. That's it.
Right.
But, yeah. So, you know, I always wanted that sort of that camp experience that you would see in movies. And probably for a lot of kids, church camp might have delivered that mm-hmm. because they would get up to shenanigans, but not for me. I was a very goody two-shoes.
Here's my theory of why summer camp movies are so good. It's because whether you went or you did not go, we all have that experience of being thrust into a strange new situation. Maybe it's the first day of school where you're in this petri dish with all of these other yeah. strangers, and suddenly the jockeying for position begins in the hierarchy, and there's the mean girls and the cool kids.
What if they don't like me? What
yeah.
if,
yeah.
That's why school movies are very popular
sure.
as well, especially yeah. especially high school movies.
But in summer camp, it's all heightened.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, because you're completely cut off. There's no TV. There's no anything else. There's nothing but camp. And I think, you know, that is one of the things I like about Wet Hot is that, you know, in watching it, you also get this the real sense that making that film was like camp for them, which it was. And so there's sort of a joy that runs through it that mm-hmm. they're all so excited to be making this ridiculous movie all together in this big group of tremendously funny people. And I think that is something that comes through whether, you know, you think the movie really works or not, which I do. I like it, but I think there's that joy that runs through it that's a lot of fun.
And that explains why they'd all want to come. I mean, because basically yes. everyone from the original movie yeah. is back.
Which is very impressive.
Plus.
Because like, some of them are stars
right.
now.
Huge. I mean, three-time like, Oscar nominee
Bradley Cooper. Is in it.
Come on.
Bradley.
So you have them, plus you have basically half of the cast of Mad Men.
Yeah.
John Hamm.
Oh, my gosh.
For no reason.
Rich Sommer, John Slattery. They're all in First Day of Camp, which... just there's a lot of like cameo action in First Day of Camp that, you know, for somebody who's a pop culture nerd, it's just like, oh my God, Weird Al is here. I don't know how to handle that.
That so. Was so random.
And that for me, all of these people, all these actors who yeah. I really respect and like, made me think I must be missing the
right.
joke.
Why
they're
don't
all
I
in
find
on
this
it.
Funny?
You know, to your point, as the biggest fan in the room, I have to say I am not actually a fan of the reboot. It was fun to kind of get the band back together, and it was great to see everybody. And, you know, there were funny moments. I mean,
sure.
I love when Elizabeth Banks, you know, she's going to go undercover as a journalist and do a story on the camp.
God, she's good.
And they're like, oh, you're not old enough to do it. And she's like, just wait. And she, like, leans over and sticks a clip in her hair and then stands back up. And they're like, oh, my God, yes.
You look 15.
It's miraculous.
You know, and so it was funny, but for me, by the end of the first episode, I was sort of satisfied and ready to let it go. So to stretch it out over...
I don't think we needed 4 hours of it.
Yeah.
So how many episodes did you watch, Chris?
I got 3 into it, and then I bailed out.
And you're
wow.
the you're the fan.
And I'm the fan.
I made it through 4.
There you
and
go,
I'm probably
going to
watch
gentlemen.
The rest,
I
if
watched,
I'm honest.
I watched all of it.
And look at her.
Because I thought,
wow.
what's the joke that I'm... I was like,
you're
so committed to figuring
there
it out.
There must be something here.
Eventually, I
must find it.
I will get to this joke.
But I think yeah. it falls flat for all the reasons we mentioned earlier. Just our that sense of humor is everywhere now. And so it doesn't,
yeah.
it's not surprising. And once you get over the fun of seeing everybody back together, it's just kind of that the same old gags and setups and kind of ironic humor that we're used to with Judd Apatow and everybody else has been doing for a while now.
Yeah, we're in a, you know, we were talking about this earlier. We're in a post Arrested Development comedy world here. And mm-hmm. so I think it's not.
And 30 Rock.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
All at Parks and Rec. It's not nearly as fresh now. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, even though I didn't really respond to it, you know, as a super fan when I initially saw it, I do think I had that response of this is different. I mean, the most emotional and touching thing in the original film is a gay sex scene with Bradley Cooper
yes.
and Michael Ian Black. Like, that was 2001. That was
and
not
do you know,
normal.
Do you know why I think that's so brilliant? Is because for a movie so filled with gags, you
yeah.
expect, oh, surprise, there's actually a gay love story going on. You would expect it to be played for a cheap laugh.
Yeah.
And they do the opposite. It becomes this very beautifully lit, completely serious, very
yeah.
explicit sex scene. And that becomes the joke.
Yeah.
You know, that
they're subverting
exactly.
the camp trope of like, oh, let's, you know, find the gay kid and pants him or whatever.
Right.
You know, I thought that was really, really great.
So they were ahead of their time.
So there's an explicit gay sex scene.
Yeah, with Bradley Cooper.
It's quite.
It's uncomfortable.
Yes, it's no joke.
Which is part of what where the humor comes from.
Yeah.
Like Brokeback Mountain explicit?
Kind of more, actually.
Actually wow. more. I would say more, yeah.
I guess Brokeback Mountain wasn't that explicit in that
Not,
in
not
that
compared
regard.
To this.
In fact, it was criticized for that.
Yeah,
for
it was more implied explicitness. This was actual.
Yeah.
Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp is on Netflix. Watch it if you want. We'll be right back. So let's move on to our touts. This is the portion of the show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, eating, drinking, or just plain obsessed with. And we're going to start with Amanda Wilkins.
So I would like to talk about Tig, which is the documentary about comedian Tig Notaro and her. It follows the 1 year period after her now legendary set, stand-up set in LA, in which she, you know, had it been diagnosed with cancer just a couple of days beforehand, and prior, you know, a few months to that, had lost her mom and also gone through a life-threatening illness. So it was a really rough time for her, and she just, you know, got out on stage and was completely raw about it, and it kind of, the comedy world just exploded over it. And so the documentary follows her in that, in the 1 year period after that, and you know, having a double mastectomy and wanting to have children and trying to get her comedy back on track because she was kind of in this lost place after that. And it's the documentary is phenomenal. I'm a huge fan of her comedy anyway, and the documentary is, it's heartbreaking and touching and funny, of course. But I mean, I cried like three different times. It's a love story. I mean, it's phenomenal, and I can't recommend it highly enough. And I came out of it an even bigger fan of her comedy than I already was, which was significant. So
where can we see it?
Oh, it's a Netflix documentary. I should have mentioned that. It is out now. It came out in July.
Oh, so they produced it. And
yes, yeah. Okay. It's a Netflix property.
So skip the Wet Hot reboot and go straight to this. And
I would recommend that. Yes,
I would. I'd second that for you.
Excellent. Excellent.
Chris Mosley.
Yeah, I'm reading a book by Roger White, who was here giving an author talk at the Wild Detectives last week, and he wrote this sort of overview of contemporary art and really humanized it, kind of like the aforementioned Penelope Spheris earlier. It's just sort of sucks like the academic aspects out of it, even though he is an academic, and just kind of introduces sort of a lot of like blood and comedy kind of back into things. And he just has a really sort of dry sense of humor. He wrote an essay about how artists should dress, and he turned it into a tote bag. And I don't know, I just kind of, he's working on a lot of levels at once.
And what's the name of the book again?
The book is called The Contemporaries. And yeah, he was also the co-founder of Paper Monument, which is an art journal. So he's just doing a lot of things at once.
Cool. Lauren Smart.
I'm going to tout a book I just breezed through called The Argonauts.
We're so bookish today.
Yeah. And it's by a woman named Maggie Nelson, and she's sort of a social critic. And she's very, this book is about gender identity and really becoming a mother in a queer family and what that is and what it means to today's society. And it really does I don't know if I was skeptical when I picked it up, but she does a really, really good job, sort of in a Joan Didion, Susan Sontag-esque way of like taking her own personal life and putting it on the page in a sort of philosophical way. And she quotes a lot of philosophers throughout it.
You just compared her to two of the greatest writers of the 20th century.
I think it's really good. No, I think it's really beautiful exploration of the Argonaut is this idea of that the ship, that we are all a ship, and that just like a ship, you can replace the parts and change and grow and stay the same person. So she sort of explores that in the book, and it's really beautiful.
And her name again?
Maggie Nelson.
Maggie Nelson.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah.
My tout is one of the best films I've seen this year. It opens Friday, and it's called The Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Oh, I'm excited to see that.
It's set in a world I know very well, 1970s San Francisco, and it really just nails sort of the darker side of what that was like, just permissiveness for everybody, including kids. And the main character is a really good British actress named Belle Pally. Ends up sleeping with her mother's boyfriend, has an affair with him, and it's just kind
so that
of
that happens. Yeah.
It's the sort of the fallout from that, but there's a certain kind of shameless, and I mean that in maybe shameless isn't the right word, a guiltless quality to it that is very much of that time and place. Kristen Wiig plays the mother. She's also fantastic. So really good debut feature film from a woman named Mariel Heller, who actually, like me, grew up in Berkeley. So I definitely connected to her sensibility and, you know, sort of the post Summer of Love era, mm-hmm. the hangover, if you will, after the party of the 60s in the Bay Area. So yeah, I say go see The Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Speaking of a lot of good buzz, I'm excited to see that.
Chris Wynn.
My Tout is a song.
Oh.
So Yola Tingo, the kind of the indie band, indie American band, they've been around forever, since the 80s. They've got a new album out called Stuff Like That There. Stuff Like That Bar. And they do a cover song of Friday I'm in Love, the Cure, kind of 1980s, late 80s, early 90s Cure song, which I hated at the time. I just thought was so ridiculous and such so throwaway, and why are you doing that, and why are you selling out? Now this song finally makes sense. They have reimagined it as kind of an alt-country, jangly number, and now I like it. So Friday I'm in Love.
Let's listen to some of that as we send you out. You'll find some links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com, the entertainment website of the Dallas Morning News. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at mixedmediapod. You can now subscribe to our show on iTunes.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah, baby. Just search for our name, Mixed Media Pod.
We're not excited.
No, not at all. Mixed Media is engineered by Brian Ellidge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn, Lauren Smart, Amanda Wilkins, and Christopher Mosley, I'm Chris Wagner. We thank you for joining us.